Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to our program. March 31st, it's the, well, tomorrow technically, I suppose, but if you go week to week, it is the fourth anniversary of Air America Radio. And welcome to two brand new affiliates, WINZ, AM 940. South Florida's Progressive Talk, AM 1120, WNWF, Destin's Progressive Talk, and also over the last couple of weeks we've added AM 930, WBAI in Bellingham, Washington, and AM 1460, WZNZ, Jacksonville's Progressive Talk Radio. So welcome to our new stations. The Federal Reserve, is possibly going to gain a whole bunch of new powers. This is the front page of today's Wall Street Journal talking about this, an article about how the headline is Paulson begins battle over how to police market. And in a sweeping proposal circulated over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson slaughtered a number of Washington sacred cows, proposing to merge or eliminate institutions of longstanding, including the Securities and Exchange Commission, and to create a controversial new role of supercop for the Federal Reserve. Now, keep in mind, the Federal Reserve is not a government agency. It's a private corporation owned by its member banks. It was chartered by the federal government, but it is not answerable to the federal government. And, in fact, famously, LBJ once, when he was unhappy that the chairman of the Fed was not lowering interest rates enough to stimulate the economy when an election was coming up, in the White House, slammed the guy, I forget his name, who was the chairman of the Fed at the time, slammed him up against the wall and yelled at him. And, but, you know, he still didn't lower rates. So what we're seeing here, in my opinion, is the privatization of the Fed. Now, this, in part, is coming out of Phil Gramm. Phil Gramm is the general co-chairman of John McCain's campaign. In 1999, he led the charge to repeal Depression-era banking regulations, as Lisa Lehrer is noting over at Politico. And there was a $300 million lobbying effort. The banking industry and the investment industry spent $300 million to get these rules rolled back. In 2003, as Paul Krugman notes in today's New York Times, or perhaps it was yesterday's New York Times. It's up on the New York Times. I believe it's today's New York Times. As Paul Krugman notes, there was a photo op in Washington, D.C., the Bush administration. They came out with yard shears, pruning shears, and one guy showed up with a chainsaw to say, we're going to cut away banking regulations. And here we are with this disaster. So is there an upside to privatizing the regulation of banking through the Fed, or is this just another Herbert Hoover response? Yaron Brook is with us. He is the president of the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged being really the seminal work that created objectivism. Objectivism being the philosophical grandfather of the modern libertarian movement and in many ways the modern conservative movement. Although I know, Yaron, you would disavow both of them. The website, by the way, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Yaron Brook, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. I cringe every time you say that.
But you also know it's true.
It's true for the libertarians. Definitely, they would not exist without Ayn Rand. I don't think it's true at all for the conservatives. I think conservatives anti Ayn Rand in every aspect of what they do, including in this latest proposal.
Yeah, there is to many of the people who call themselves conservatives now, but so many of the old-fashioned Barry Goldwater conservatives, I mean, they just take the Cato Institute talking points and run with them. So, anyhow, our question for the hour is John McCain's modern version of Reaganomics destroying not only the middle class, but America itself?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I'm going to agree with you, but for completely different reasons. I think the problem with John McCain is he is far too moderate. He's far too, too appeasing of the special interests and the various interests within Washington. I disagree with the way you've presented the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a quasi-government entity. The government appoints its board of governors. They can
But that's it.
You know, they can.
Congress cannot pass a law telling the Federal Reserve to change any of their policies.
I would like to see the Federal Reserve truly privatized. That is, to eliminate it. I'd like to see the Federal Reserve gone and to return to true private banking. And I think the latest proposal by Paulson is a disaster, because it's the Federal Reserve that caused the problems we're facing today. And giving the Federal Reserve more power seems to me, you know, absurd given its role in creating the crisis we're
in today. But to the extent that the Federal Reserve created the problem, and I agree with you that cheap money, you know, that Alan Greenspan, you know, basically trying to help out the Bush administration, in my opinion, driving interest rates down. Actually, we had negative interest rates here for about a year and a half.
Oh, we still do. We have negative interest rates right now.
Yeah, we're back to
negative real interest.
Where the rate at which you can borrow money is below the inflation rate. So if you borrow money and simply sit on it and then pay it back, you and I can't, but banks can borrow money at a negative interest rate.
It encourages leverage. I mean, people talk about all this leverage.
Right.
What happens when interest rates are so low is it encourages banks and other financial institutions to borrow money that in normal economic times they would never do.
But here's the problem. With an unregulated system, as you would advocate, I believe, I think I'm accurately characterizing your worldview, your point of view, that Washington should not be regulating the banking industry or the investment industry whatsoever, and certainly should not be bailing out Bear Stearns, which in that regard I agree with you. But in the absence of regulation, what's to stop the predators? I mean, I would argue that, you know, cheap money made this easy, but what made it possible was the fact that the regulations that were put in place after the last Republican Great Depression, that were put into place by the Roosevelt administration, principally starting in 1935 with the Glass-Steagall Act, that these regulations that were repealed, that was repealed in 1998 by Clinton, these regulations that were repealed led directly to allowing people to engage in the kind of predatory and deceptive behavior, deceptive to their stockholders, deceptive to their owners, that brought us this crisis. And that without regulation, you can't stop that kind of behavior in advance. Your solution only solves problems after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree in the way you phrased the problem. I think there were deceptive practices, but they were made mainly at the mortgage level, at the mortgage broker level. I don't think Wall Street was engaged in deceptive practices. I think that they believed their own hype. I think they bought into
There's a fair amount of evidence that the bond rating agencies were lying.
Well, but the bond agencies, again, there's no competition for bond agencies. The bond agencies, again, quasi-government entities. I mean,
Moody's is not a quasi-government entity.
Sure they are. I mean, they have to be.
It's a private corporation.
Well, but they're private corporations, just like Fannie Mae and Freddie.
No, it's a private corporation like General Motors.
Look, they're not, because they have to be licensed by the government. There are only three rating agencies approved by the government. If you're a new competitor and you want to come in and rate securities, you cannot do it without getting the government's permission to do it. And no new rating agency has been approved in decades because they're basically a government monopoly. But look, in a free market, none of this would have happened. None of this would have happened because everybody's a loser here. The market itself is a loser. Bear Stearns is a loser. The shareholders of Bear Stearns would have never allowed something like this to happen.
The executives of Bear Stearns are doing fairly well.
What happens with regulations is that these companies hide behind the regulations. They use regulations in order to deceive their shareholders and to deceive everybody else.
But you're on, then why is it that during the late 1700s and the early 1800s, and particularly after the failure of the first U.S. bank and the second U.S. bank, I think the second one failed in, 1846, was it? And that was the end of private banking, basically, in the United States.
No.
Government-sanctioned banking, excuse me.
Government-sanctioned banking.
Yeah. And we went into an era. We went into a laissez-faire era, like you're advocating, from 1846 until arguably 1913.
Yep.
And we saw a series. I mean, about every 8 to 15 years, depending on how you're measuring it, there was a panic. I mean, the Great Panic of 1896, the Great Panic of the 1870s, there was one just before the Civil War that some people think started the Civil War. And there was a whole series of these things that were all the result of this kind of predatory behavior.
Look, in my view, the banking system and the economy between the Civil War and 1913 were far more stable than they are today. Way in which we exited the panics was much healthier for the economy than it is today. People made bad decisions and bad choices they suffered for them. They weren't bailed out by taxpayers. It worked as a market. Firms fail in a marketplace.
But the middle class was whacked. I mean, during that period of time, there was virtually no middle class in America.
That's not true. That's your rewriting of history. During that period of time, the middle class in America was created. That is the time where the middle class was created. It was the time of the highest economic growth in American history, indeed in world history.
For the robber barons.
Well, the robber barons were good guys. The robber barons are bad designation for some of the most brilliant, wealth-creating, job-creating entrepreneurs in American history.
People can read all about it over at your website, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. You're on, Brooke. Thanks for dropping by today.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks. Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live coast-to-coast, border-to-border, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. So here it is. The Financial Times lays it out in pretty straightforward fashion in a paper last week. They say the credit world, this is the headline is on the western front of the credit world, the credit world is aligning itself into political factions, divided over the right approach to untangle the present mess. And this is the bottom line, really. On one side are the fundamentalists, with one hand on the Bloomberg keyboard and the other on a dog-eared copy of Atlas Shrugged. These are the folks who say, nah, no regulation at all. We don't need no stinking regulation. Let the banks do whatever they want. Get the government out of it altogether. And that's the Phil Graham, John McCain perspective. On the other hand, you've got, hey, the little guy gets screwed. He's just the little guy. He doesn't contribute to Republican campaigns. And then on the other side, back to the Financial Times article, opposed to them are the would-be managers of systemic risk. You could call them Keynesians, except that Keynes was strongly opposed to currency debasement, which is another thing that the Republicans are doing right now, destroying our currency. On the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, this article that I started with, Paulson begins playing. Paulson is our Treasury Secretary, right? A former investment banker, multi-millionaire, and he begins this battle over how to police the market. And basically what he's saying is, let's cut back on the number of regulators and give all this power to the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve is a private corporation. In other words, let's privatize more of the American economy. And in fact, you look at the number of regulators, and you can see this on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. In 1997, this was before, keep in mind, in 98, Clinton ended the Glass-Steagall Act, the act that made it illegal for banks to get into the gambling business, basically, into the brokerage business, and vice versa. And so that was done away. I mean, that was put into place in 1935, either 34 or 35. It was one of the very first pieces of legislation Roosevelt passed in order to stop banks from doing what they had been doing, which is what led to all these bank failures. So anyway, you look at the number of regulators in 1997, the year before we started this deregulation of banking and investment. There were 6,022 federal regulators, 2,053 of them at the FDIC. That's the FDIC that guarantees your deposits to the banks. Today, that 2,053 regulators at FDIC, they're down to 1,690. And total, they've gone from 6,022 down to 5,878. In other words, as at a time when U.S. commercial banking assets, the money held in U.S. banks, has risen from almost $5 trillion in 1997 to almost $12 trillion, 11 and change, right now. It's just about tripled the amount of money being held in U.S. banks the number of regulators, the number of people who are looking at your money and my money and your bank and my bank and making sure that they're being kosher and copacetic and doing things right, has dropped. And this, again, gets back to this $300 million lobbying effort that Phil Gramm was a part of. Phil Gramm, who is the co-chairman of the John McCain Committee. Phil Gramm, who is the primary economic advisor to John McCain. Phil Gramm, who was the sponsor of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which repealed these old regulations. And in fact, as Lisa Lehrer points out over at Politico, a year after Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act repealed the old regulations, Swiss bank UBS gobbled up, and they had been one of the big donors to the lobbying cause, gobbled up brokerage house Payne Webber. Okay, so Payne Webber, an American company, gets bought out by the Swiss. Gramm lobbied Congress, the Federal Reserve, and Treasury Department about banking and mortgage issues in 2005-2006. Gramm and other lobbyists collect $750,000 in fees. Meanwhile, in the past year, UBS has now written down more than $18 billion in exposure to subprime loans. In other words, the average guy got screwed to the tune, well, and actually some wealthy investors as well, got screwed to the tune of $18 billion. Phil Gramm, though, made $750,000. And as Lisa notes over political, now some housing experts and economists see Graham's thinking in the recent housing proposal from McCain. Gramm is often a surrogate for the senator. Gramm and McCain have a long political history. They both became, this is just incredible, the two became close when they worked together as senators to defeat Hillary Rodham Clinton's 1993 health care plan, holding meetings at hospitals and clinics across the country. Phil Gramm and John McCain, Phil Gramm, one of the leading guys who arguably led to the deregulation that led directly to this disaster, this housing disaster and this whole, you know, speculative bubble bursting disaster. Phil Gramm going around to hospitals and clinics with John McCain, the two of them doing a song and dance back in 1993, specifically to defeat Hillary Clinton's health care proposal. How crazy is that? This is the Republican plan.
Let's have less government regulation. Let's have more of the average guy getting screwed.
Amazing. Your thoughts on this? By the way, I have to share with you what Muammar Gaddafi just said. Incredible what's going on in the Middle East right now. We'll talk about that briefly. Also today coming up in our second hour is the middle class getting screwed. In our third hour, what about spies in the sky in Miami? Stick around.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6:34 past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And strange stuff, crazy stuff going on out there. Maybe. Maybe they are in Iowa City. Oh, this has got nothing to do with the elections. County officials have given their informal okay for ghost hunters to check out a one-time Iowa insane asylum to see if any spirits are lurking about. Brandon Cochran, museum operations assistant, said there has never been reports of ghosts or bizarre happenings at the building, and bringing in a paranormal team is kind of taking a preemptive approach. It was the Johnson County Board of Supervisors that took the initial action on the request from the Johnson County Historical Society. A four-person Carroll area paranormal team will use thermal imaging equipment and voice recording systems. The building is now called Chatham Oaks and houses people with physical and mental disabilities. Very, very strange. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop by our website. There's a message board there. Also, I just put up, over the weekend, yesterday in fact, a whole bunch of new pictures from our trip 2 weeks ago to Darfur. And so you can, and it's on the Tom's blog section. So if you go to TomHartmann.com and just over on the right click Tom's blog, it's the top entry in, or actually I think now it's probably the second or third entry, but you'll see all those photos there and complete with captions and things. Get a sense of what it was like. Muammar Gaddafi kicked off the Arab summit on Saturday. This is amazing. Now, this is a guy who was our ally and then was our enemy. You'll remember Ronald Reagan bombed his compound, killed his daughter, and then now he's our ally again because he'll sell us oil. Bush has said, "Oh yeah, it's fine. You know, you pay off the, you know, paid off the families from Lockerbie, and now you're a friend." So Muammar Gaddafi comes out and he says, "How can we accept that a foreign power comes to topple?" And well, actually, let me begin at the beginning. The Arab Summit. This by an article by Maki Al Nazal and Dar Jamail in the Interpress Service. The Arab summit kicked off Saturday with a fiery speech by Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi attacking fellow Arab leaders for doing nothing while the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. What? What, they were supposed to all rise up against us? Apparently. He said, "How can we accept that a foreign power comes to topple an Arab leader while we stand watching?" Saddam Hussein, he said, had once been our ally, had been an ally of Washington, but they sold him out, he said. Then he pointed to Arab officials at the conference to say, "Your turn is next." He said, "Where is the Arabs' dignity, their future, their very existence? Everything has disappeared." 866-303-2270, our telephone number. John in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening to KPHX.
Good
morning. John.
I just wanted to put in a word for the robber barons.
Yeah. The good guys, yeah.
While J.B. Morgan and the boys, this was 1913, they were meeting in the basement of the stock market, figuring out that they couldn't handle that depression, and that's how the seats of the Fed Reserve is my reading. But I just wanted to mention, with respect to the people that went through those tragedies, the mining disasters, the people who lost their lives in mining, the 12 to 16-hour work weeks that women and children in almost slave labor conditions went through, and that this continued until there was almost a revolt. And then if you look at Friedman, you know, the free market practices.
Right. And Milton Friedman. And Tom Friedman, for that matter.
Yeah,
and also look at the history of the Wobblies and go back to... Yeah, and look at the Wobblies, and you go back to Joe Hill, you know, being assassinated in Salt Lake City.
Let's look at Argentina, where, you know, they tried to privatize the economy.
Yep.
And Pinochet is disappearing people, torturing them, putting them in stadiums. And these are politicians as well as union leaders and leaders of the left. And Milt Friedman gets on a plane and goes down to Argentina and says exactly what your guest said. I don't want to talk to him about him in his absence. But he said what Chile needed was more of the same.
Yeah.
No, torture chambers, killing people, taking people...
And it all came out of economics. No, you're absolutely right, John, and very well said. And it all came out of economics, this idea that, just throw the whole thing open. Government has no role in anything. And Milton Friedman championing that, Tom Friedman and the olive tree and the Lexus. And the Lexus, by the way, wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for government intervention. It was the government of Japan intervening in the marketplace that took the Toyota Loom Company and helped it become a car company by protecting them with tariffs that prevented foreign companies from competing with them while they built it. I mean, it's just absolutely nuts. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, welcome to the program.
Welcome to you, Mr. Hartman.
Well, thank you.
Listening on WINZ.
Oh, great.
For the first time.
Very pleased to be on WINZ.
Something that bothered me, well, there's two things. One thing is about Darfur. They said Ben and Jerry's, they're going to target China.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent a convoy to San Francisco, a three-vehicle convoy, with messages on it such as, "China's disgrace playing games in Darfur."
Right.
I think that's great.
I saw it. We met with Salva Kiir, who is the president of South Sudan, the vice president of all of Sudan. There's this 21-year civil war, and he's the leader of the South now. And he said that China, they found oil now in South Sudan, and China is pumping the oil, and China is... And 50% of the oil revenue from the South goes to the North, goes to the government of Khartoum. 100% of the oil revenue from the North goes to Khartoum, to the government of the North. Only half of it goes to the South. And there's been no accounting. They're trying to get the Norwegians in to account for it because the North just kind of writes them checks. It's the North that is bombing Darfur and killing people and doing the genocide against Darfur. And so Salva Kiir pointed out that the Chinese were a big part of the problem. And this is what Steven Spielberg, pointed out. That's why he left the whole Olympic thing.
So it's being exposed, and thanks to people like Ben and Jerry.
Yeah.
And I support their, I like their ice cream too.
Yeah, God bless them. I know Ben Coney. They're great people. They are absolutely great people.
They're always there for the right causes.
Yep, but you wanted to call about the Federal Reserve.
Yes, I did. On Friday night, in a business report, the Bush administration appointed two Democrats to Securities and Exchange. And I was happy about that. They had been operating with just the Republicans.
Right.
For weeks, they said, which isn't right.
Yeah.
And then the following day on Saturday, Paulson comes out and he says he has to change things. So the Securities and Exchange is in place to protect investors. That's their job.
Right.
Bill Moyers had a whole show on it. And in the meantime, we have people like Citigroup. They're going to, in last week's newspaper, they're going to pay $1.66 billion to creditors of Enron who lost money when the energy trader collapsed in 2001. But they said in 2003, there was a mega lawsuit against 11 banks and brokerages that alleges that they kept the financial troubles using shady practices out of the public. So with the accounting and the consulting that...
This is the thing. Without good oversight and without good regulation, what you're going to have is the predators coming out of the woodwork. And Flo, you've said it so well. And thank you very much for the call. It has happened so many times before in our past, and we learned from it in the 1930s, and we put into place systems that prevented it. And banking became a nice, boring business, which is what it should be. You want the guys who are controlling your money to be wearing green eye shades and making a decent wage and a decent pension, and that's it. And not trying to, not being get rich quick artists, which is what happened. And, Bear Stearns and everybody else, I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. And in 2003, the Bush administration holding this press conference where they're deregulating the banks, and they're showing up with chainsaws and lawn shears to cut the regulations. Come on, give me a break. Jerry in New Mexico. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better.
You're certainly a great voice out there.
Thank you.
I have a bone to pick with you on the Reaganomics, because you always refer to that.
Yeah.
Which is the basic construct of supply side, borrow, and spend.
Yes.
And
supply side and borrow and spend are two separate things.
Borrow
and spend was Reagan's way of stimulating the economy.
He
generated about a $3 trillion debt. And during that time, I always said, give me a credit card with a $1 trillion line of credit, and I'll show you what it looks like to live large. I mean, to the extent that the economy was good during Reagan, and it really was, I mean, we had a severe recession early on in the Reagan administration, but the extent to which it looked good toward the end was because he was borrowing and spending. That was stimulus. But the supply side part of it was the idea that the only reason that anybody does anything in an economy is because they're incentivized to produce. And that's absolutely backwards. The reason why companies, and speaking as a businessman who has started 7 businesses in my life and done very well with many of them, thank you very much, the only reason I ever started a business, the only reason anybody I know has ever started a business, and I've employed a couple hundred people over the years, is because there is a demand out there for something. Demand-side economics is Adam Smith 101. I mean, classical economics, people for 7,000 years going back to ancient Sumeria have understood that when there's a demand for something, then you start a business to fulfill that demand. But Reagan comes along and says, well, let's just give a whole bunch of tax breaks and billions of dollars to wealthy people in the hopes that they will build factories and start producing supply. And in fact, they took the money and they either A, invested it, or B, did build their factories in China. And so it's like, it's crazy. It's an insane form of economics.
I just kind of look at the stuff that goes on today is a little bit different. And I like to use a term, and I haven't heard it anywhere. I don't know if it's mine or if somebody else has said it, but either neocon or neocond economics.
Neocon.
And that's basically the borrow and steal crowd.
There you go. There you go. Well said, Jerry. Jerry, thank you very much. Reaganomics, borrow and steal. Well, borrow, steal, spend. I mean, look at all these guys who are walking off with billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. How many executives of Bear Stearns, the senior guys are losing their pensions 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
storm that's coming, I'm telling you, is the Democrats. We're going to take this country back. And people say to me, you know, why are you supporting the Democrats? Why, you know, some kind of partisan thing or something? I'm somebody who in 2000, and I say I've lived in Vermont, so I knew it was a safe vote. But in 2000, I voted for Ralph Nader. In 2004, obviously, I voted for John Kerry. But, you know, why support the Democratic Party? I'm not just supporting the Democratic Party. I am suggesting that you and I should be showing up at the meetings, that we should be participating in the party, that we should be engaging the party, that we should infiltrate it and take it over. That's far more radical than just supporting it. And so, anyhow, this is a pivotal year. The Supreme Court is hanging in the balance. I'm telling you, it's the Supreme Court that's hanging in the balance. Larry in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to your free market enthusiast guest. I didn't catch his name. I'm sorry.
Yaron Brookes. He's the president of the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yeah, and he wants to blame the mortgage crisis on the brokers, on the mortgage brokers. Why was the mortgage broker?
Well, actually, I think he was blaming them on the borrowers. I misunderstood.
Yeah, I heard him say the brokers.
That's okay. Right. All right. Great.
So I was in the business from 2000 until 2006 when we closed the business down. My wife was in the business for 19 years before that. And I'll tell you how this happened. This happened because this fiasco happened. The lenders send out account executives, who are basically salesmen, to tell you how to massage their guidelines.
Right.
And I remember very clearly about the beginning of 2000, as the regulatory mechanisms shrank out of view, our options for doing that massaging became abundant.
Thus the ninja loans, the no income, no assets loans
You know, the way that they did it was very subtle. I remember very well the day that they stopped requiring wet signatures on documents when all of a sudden all you had to do was fax something in. They never expected to see the original.
Hmm.
And what we're talking about is a validation of the information that we had put down on the loan documents, where people had lived, their rent, their verification of rent, their verification of employment, their verification of prior mortgage. If I can send you a fax document, all you have to tell me is what you want on it, because I can photocopy people's signatures, and I can photocopy.
Well, this is the Oregonian, the local paper here in Portland, got a hold of a copy of an internal memo at J.P. Morgan Chase that was apparently not anything that the bank itself was sanctioning, but it was a memo that was circulating among the various folks involved in executing these mortgages and also in bundling them, that was about how to trick their computer system so that it would automatically approve. approve loans that shouldn't have been approved. I mean, it's just incredible. It's just
I'm not a bit surprised. And when these people came around, what they told us constantly was, "This is what the investors want."
Yeah, and
this is what the investors want.
And over the short term, it was. Larry, thank you very much for your point. And over the short term, it was, and now the investors are caught holding the short end of the stick. I mean, it was what the people making the commissions wanted, certainly. This is where the whole Reagan greed is good thing breaks down. It just breaks down. Tim in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I got a question. I got a question. What are your thoughts on actually eliminating the Federal Reserve and then putting all the money stuff into, say, to the U.S. Treasury? Because I know three... libertarians who want to eliminate the Federal Reserve and then put the money back into the Treasury.
Yeah. I'm ambivalent about it, and here's why. On the one hand, I think it's crazy that we have privatized our money supply with the Federal Reserve. And just like I think it's crazy that we would privatize voting by giving electronic voting machines to, and having the corporations say, sorry, you can't look inside, you can't read the software. I think that's nuts.
Right.
On the other hand, if the Treasury Department is issuing money and has control over the rate at which the currency is debased, inflation, and the Fed doesn't have the greatest record on this. A dollar right now is worth about a penny, or maybe 2 or 3 cents in 1913. would buy what a dollar will buy today. But if the Treasury is responsible for that and has control over that, when we see how the Bush administration, for example, and they're not unique in this, there have been several administrations that have done this, a number of them, probably the majority of them, where they fudge numbers, they fudge unemployment numbers, they fudge inflation numbers, they cook the books constantly. If the executive branch of government had control over the issuing of our currency and that sort of thing, then, you know, I think that we may have some legitimate concerns. And that's why, you know, Jefferson was opposed to Alexander Hamilton's argument that we should have a national bank. And Hamilton won that argument. We did have a national bank, and it crashed and burned. And then it got reinvented in the 1820s, and it crashed and burned again in 1846. And both times it took down a lot of small investors and average people. It just wiped them out. And so I frankly don't know an alternative to the Fed right now, other than perhaps strengthening federal oversight of the Fed, giving Congress some oversight of the Fed, but you know, it's not one of those black and white things where you can just say, oh yeah, do away with it tomorrow. Virtually every industrialized country in the world has gone to a privatized banking system like the Fed. You know, all of Europe, the EC is an identical system. The Bank of England, identical system. It's not actually owned by the government. It's a private corporation. Right. And
I'm sorry. Didn't Kennedy do that when he brought up the Treasury notes?
No. I mean, there was I don't think that was during the Kennedy administration. Wasn't that during the Nixon administration when we went off the gold standard and they stopped saying that our currency was redeemable in gold and started
like the red dollar and blue dollar. I mean, the green dollar or blue dollars and red dollars.
Yeah, I don't remember which administration it was, but yeah, we went from this dollar is redeemable in gold to this dollar is, you know, the full faith and credit of the United States. But you know, and maybe we should go back to the gold standard. I mean, that or something like that. That might be a reasonable return. 57 minutes past here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to our program. In today's Washington Post, Keith Richburg and Ashley Serdin writing, in Illinois' Cook County, women in poor neighborhoods no longer have access to free mammograms from two mobile vans testing for breast cancer. In Michigan, hikers will find about 20 campgrounds closed. Scientists are ending their studies of fish populations in the Great Lake. In New Jersey, state workers are being laid off, and at least one town is canceling its 4th of July fireworks. And in California's San Fernando Valley, Eduardo Orozco, 53, who has AIDS, exhausted his medical benefits and can no longer afford the drugs that are keeping him alive. At least half of the nation's states are facing budget shortfalls, some of them severe. The Congressional Research Service, at the request of Senator Bernie Sanders, pulled together the following information. Since George Bush became president, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty in the United States. Nearly 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Median household income has gone down by nearly $1,300 adjusted for inflation. 3 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home floor closures are now the highest on record. The personal savings rate is below zero, which hasn't happened since the Great Depression. The real earnings of college graduates are down by 5%. Over the last 4 years. Entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates have fallen by over 3% over the last 6 years, and wages and salaries are now at the lowest share of GDP since 1929. In the face of this, Professor Brad Schiller writes in the Wall Street Journal in March 10th an article called The Inequality Myth. The Professor Schiller is a professor of economics at the American University and the University of Nevada, Reno, and an economist. And Professor Schiller, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Sir, is America's middle class being wiped out? You seem to suggest that's not so, and I think everything I just recited seems to suggest it is.
Well, it's hard to be optimistic at a time like this when the economy is slowing markedly. But the reality is that the middle class has not lost ground over the last year, 8 years. The reality is there's been revolutionary changes in the family. The traditional family has broken down. Lots of young people have got residences of their own. The retired population has got residences of their own. And as a result of these revolutionary changes in the family, the average family income has gone down. It's like if you have a basketball team where the average height is 6 foot six, and then you pick up a 6 foot two point guard, the average height declines, but no one is actually shorter. And that's exactly what's happened with the income statistics. We've got many more families and households than we had before, but they're smaller. As a result, household incomes, as measured by the census, go down, even though no one is actually worse off.
Well, I noticed in your article that you were using quintiles. You were using the top 20%, middle each of the three middle 20%, and the bottom 20%. At one point, you referred to the top 10, the top and bottom 10%. But when we look at the top 1%, since 1973, which is really when this whole deregulation thing began, and it really went on steroids in 80, 81 with Reagan, the average income of the top 1%, we're just looking, now we're not talking family incomes, we're talking individual incomes. The average income of the top 1% of Americans has doubled, and the income of the top 1/10 of 1%, that's only 145,000 people, has tripled. While the average income of anybody in those three middle quintiles has declined by about 3% in real terms, real inflation adjusted terms, and at the bottom it's dropped more than 3.4%.
Okay, and the answer to that is, first of all, there is widening inequality. It is, there's no question that the rich have gotten richer faster than the middle class has gained income, or that the poor have gained income. The misleading part of it is to portray the middle class incomes as going down in real terms.
Well, if their income is even stable, we have energy prices tripling, we have food prices increasing, we have transportation prices increasing, we have housing prices dramatically increasing, how can you say that the middle class is not being wiped out or not being harmed?
Well, I'm saying it's twofold. First of all, the real income statistics adjust for the rising prices of fuel, clothing, housing, and food. So we're talking about real incomes. And what I'm suggesting is, because of the tremendous growth in the size of the population, fueled by 3 million new people a year, half of those immigrants, as a result of all this growth of the population, mostly at the low end, the middle people who were in the middle class in 1973 or 1983 or 1993 have moved up, and they have been replaced by people who are in lower incomes moving into the middle class.
But aren't you averaging quintiles here? I mean, isn't this your basketball story? It's like, you know, you and me are sitting in a bar, and Bill Gates walks in, and all of a sudden the average income among the three of us is $14 billion, or the average wealth, rather.
Correct. And in that case, you'd say your income and my income didn't go up just because the average went up.
Right. But I'm suggesting that what you're doing is you're averaging these quintiles, when really we should be looking at the individual, you know, that if you pull out that top 1/10 of 1% or the top 1% or even arguably the top 10%, that the whole picture starts to change. Just like if you pull out the bottom 5 or 10%.
Well, to use your analogy, if a homeless person walked into the bar, our average incomes would decline, but you and I would be no worse off.
Right, but the homeless person isn't as dramatically poorer than you and I are as Bill Gates is dramatically wealthier than you and I are.
That's true, but...
And that's that inequality gap.
The notion of the homeless entering the bar and lowering average incomes is much closer to the reality of what's been happening in the United States over the last 20 years, with all the growth in immigration and young people entering the labor force. Even when you talk about the decline in real wages, the reality is we've had tremendous growth of the labor market over the last 10 years, all at the lower end. The immigrants coming in at the very lowest wages, the high school graduates entering the labor market at minimum wages or slightly more, that brings down the average wage, even if it doesn't lower any specific person's wage.
But at the same time, the top is rising. The top 1% of Americans receive more income. We're talking actual income, and we're not talking households here. Top 1% receive more income than the entire bottom 40%, the bottom two quintiles.
Yes, and I don't mean to suggest that we don't have problems of inequality. What I am suggesting is that the revolutionary changes in the composition and size of the household and the persistent flow of immigrants into the country at the low end of the income and wage distribution
is skewing our data.
Distorted what's happened to the family wage.
You say that that's skewing the data.
Extremely skewing the data.
So what do we do about this? I mean, during from the middle of the Great Depression until basically Ronald Reagan came along, the top income tax rate, if you made more than $3.2 million in today's dollars, was 90, 91%, and then Kennedy took it down to 70%, although Kennedy actually sold that as a tax increase and gave that speech during the debate with Nixon where he said, I'm proposing to actually increase revenues by closing loopholes.
Right.
He said he was in the 90, 91% tax bracket, and he never paid that because there were all these loopholes. And he actually closed loopholes, and even though he lowered the top marginal tax rate, he increased taxes on the wealthy. And that served as a natural kind of balance system that allowed people to get wealthy, but not allowed us to have a landed gentry, the robber barons. We didn't see throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and arguably up until 1981, we didn't see the emergence of hyper wealth in the United States. There were no dynasties created during that 40-year period. There were before that. When there wasn't this progressive taxation, you had the robber barons, and you know, from the 1870s all the way up to the 1920s, and since then, since the 1980s, we've had, you know, multi billionaires emerge as a consequence of the reduction of this high tax rate. How is that not feeding inequality?
Well, first of all, I think you should point out that Kennedy's tax reforms were very modest compared to what Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan actually lowered the top tax rate from 70% to a low of 28%.
Right.
And in his 1986 tax reforms, broadened the tax base so that the tax burden paid by the rich actually rose more under Reagan than it did under Kennedy.
Well, and the taxes paid by average working people dramatically increased. I mean, Reagan signed the largest tax increase on working people in the history of this country. He doubled FICA.
There's no question that Social Security tax, FICA tax, is the biggest burden on low-income groups, much larger than the federal income tax.
So my point is, shouldn't we go back to the kind of progressive income tax we had during the New Deal, and that Republicans like Dwight Eisenhower were fond of, to act as a flywheel against these accumulations of great wealth? And we have about 15 seconds here, so.
Well, I think you're right. If we want to make taxes more progressive, we have got to close loopholes. I don't think it's so much a question of raising the rates as closing the loopholes.
Okay. Interesting conversation. Professor Bradley Schiller, he's a professor of economics at the American University and the University of Nevada in Reno. His article, The Inequality Myth, you can read it over at the Wall Street Journal website, WSJ.com. And we have a link, sir, to your website as well off our website, TomHartmann.com. Thanks so much for dropping by. Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Past the hour, the Tom Hartmann radio program brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our local affiliates. Put their bumper sticker on your car. Listen for their advertisers and call them, let them know that you're listening. And if you don't need to buy their products, refer your friends to them. Let them know you're supporting them, as well as our national sponsors. 22 minutes past the hour. Boy, over in our chat room, some great links. You can get to our chat room by going to tomhartmann.com and just click live chat, and it'll get you in there. And it is, let's see, there was one in particular here. It scrolls pretty fast. That I thought was really great. We are now looking. Here it is. January foreclosures up 57%. And then there's a link to Money Magazine on that. So it's tough times in America. And what's the solution? Well, John McCain says the solution is just let the market, that is to say the predators, work it all out. I don't think so. Back in 2004, just before the 2004 election, and this is a real echo, just a blast into the past, because this has been, as I said, this has been going on since Reagan came into office on steroids, consistently through all of these administrations. The Clinton administration slowed it down a little bit, but the train has been going down that same the era of big government is over track all this time. And E.J. Montini, a writer for the Arizona Republic, a great writer and editorialist, got a phone call. And he put it up, he wrote about it in the Arizona Republic, azcentral.com, and put the audio file on online. And it is absolutely remarkable. He says, this week I got a call, this is March 4th, 2004. He said, this week I got a call from America, who happens to be a 43-year-old unemployed woman living in the Valley. America got my answering machine and left a message. George Bush's line must have been busy. John Kerry was probably out of town.
I'm calling in, and I'm promising myself not to cry, but you're always right about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old, and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years, and we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have three children. One that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college. But anyway, I just wonder, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on. And nobody, you see, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about it. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, I'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, anyway, we're an invisible section. But I think there's like millions of us, so... Anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything, and you make it good. And nobody hears us. So I...
To respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
And E.J. Montini says, we are America, too. Too bad we are a country that does not listen very well, even though we're all talking to ourselves, even when we're all talking to ourselves. He says, although she didn't leave a name and number, I knew when she got cut off and my answering machine was listing my options that I wanted to respond to her message. I wanted to forward it. I had no intention of deleting it, and I could not skip it. E.J. Montini writing in the Arizona Republic. The states being hit hard by the economic downturn, the impact is being felt disproportionately by the most needy. This marginal revolution, the top 1% of income earners, their share has risen from 8% of all income in the United States, the top 1%. To 1980, the year Reagan came into office, to 16%. It's doubled in 2004. The statistics are absolutely mind-boggling. And 358 billionaires, this was 10 years ago, 358 billionaires were then worth $760 billion, the same as the poorest 20% of all people on the planet. So what should we do about this? I'm calling for a new deal, a second New Deal. We need to revisit the lessons of John Maynard Keynes. We learned this stuff before. We did it right. We've been drinking the Kool-Aid for 28 years. It's time to go back to what worked and built America. 866-303-2270. Your call's up next. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Come on.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio. Check out our website, TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com, Tom Hartman page there. You'll find links from both over to our live chat room where you can drop in and say hi. No fee or anything like that. Just drop in and say hello. And also our blog and our message board and all kinds of cool stuff. Well, strange stories in the wire services. This totally strange. Among the many milestones in Don Zirkle's life, serving in the Army, editing the Tablet, the Diocese of Brooklyn's newspaper, working in the State Division of Human Rights under Governor Mario Cuomo, perhaps the most famous will now be his arrest at the food court in the Smith Haven Mall. On Saturday, Don Zirkle, 80 years old, was at an anti-war rally outside the mall in Lake Grove wearing a T-shirt splotched with red and emblazoned with a simple message. 4,000 troops, 1 million Iraqis dead, enough. That's all his T-shirt said. 4,000 troops, 1 million Iraqis dead, enough. During the rally, Zirkle and his wife went into the mall's food court for coffee and French fries after he declined mall security's request to either leave the T-shirt, either turn the T-shirt inside out or leave. He said police put him in a wheelchair and escorted him from the mall. Suffolk police charged him with criminal trespass and resisting arrest. He was released on bail and is due to be arraigned on May 21st in Central Islip. He says, I'm being punished for six words that spoke the truth. That's insanity. War is insanity. Indeed. Okay, so George W. Bush. What has George Bush, speaking of the Twilight Zone, what has George W. Bush brought us? Look at the beginning of his administration, January 20th, 2001, to today. Real GDP growth at the beginning of his administration, what Bill Clinton had, 4.09% over the prior 8 years. Bush, over the last 7 years, 2.65%. National debt was $5.7 trillion when he came into office. Now it's $9.2 trillion. The national budget surplus was $431 billion when he came into office. It's now $734 billion. Over the previous 8 years before he came into office, 1.76 million jobs per year had been created. Over the last 7 years, he's created an average of around 300,000 jobs per year, 369,000. We went from 38 million uninsured to 47 million uninsured. The average premium for insurance was $6,200 when Bush came into office. It is now $12,106. The average median household income increased by $6,000 per family over the 8 years of the Clinton administration. It has decreased by $1,100 per family in the 6 years of the Bush administration. Price of gas has gone from $1.39 a gallon to $3 and change. Cost of college has gone from $3,100 to $5,200 per year. The personal savings rate under the last years of the Clinton administration, 2.3%. Now it's -0.5%. Total consumer debt from $7.65 trillion to $12 trillion. And it just goes on and on. It's mind-boggling. This presidency is nothing more or less than an absolute disaster. John in Ithaca, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hello. Nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you for listening to 1470 AM. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to talk. I really don't hear much about how if President Bush would have privatized Social Security, how much of a devastation it would have been, because a lot of that money would have been put into companies like Bear Stearns and all these other.
That's right. Have you noticed that these guys aren't talking about privatizing Social Security anymore?
What's that?
Have you noticed that these guys are not talking about privatizing Social Security?
Because they know it would have been a huge disaster.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't hear nobody talking about how it would have just destroyed tons of people's lives.
You know, this,
I mean,
no,
because all these bigwigs think of themselves. When they're investing money, it's not theirs. They're going to think about getting themselves rich. They're not going to worry about you and me. They're just going to worry about themselves, and that's basically what we've seen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, John, and well said. And in fact, back, I mean, this today is the fourth anniversary of Air America Radio. It's this month we're starting the sixth year of this radio program. We were actually on the air for a year and a half before Air America started. And then, you know, since I replaced Al Franken on Air America, we've been, you know, rolling along. But in that 6 years, I would say for five of those 6 years, on probably every 2-3 months, you know, because we debate a lot of conservatives on this program, there would be some conservative come along and say, hey, let's debate privatizing Social Security. We tried. This is a week or so ago. Sean Taylor, my producer, is smiling right now. We tried to find a conservative, any conservative politician, any conservative think tank, anywhere, who would come on this program and debate privatization of Social Security last week, and were unable to find one single person who would defend that position. They have just stopped talking about it. Gee, what a surprise. Barbara in Illinois, listening to WINI. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
I just had a question about, since we're talking about economic things, what's to stop the free fall of the dollar since the Fed is basically just creating more and more money to bail out these corporations?
Are we
going to end up like Brazil's problem a few years back, or some of the other South American countries? Are we going to have a dollar that's worth nothing?
I think so. I think that we're going to see, I don't think that we're going to see Weimar Republic or Zimbabwean style hyperinflation, you know, 1,000%, 10,000%. But I think that what the Bush administration is doing right now is destroying the value of our currency. And what the Fed is doing right now is destroying the value of our currency. And you're going to see the impact of that over the next 4 or 5 years in a big way. And I think that they have created, and Barbara, thank you for the call, they have created such a disaster, such an economic disaster with 30 years of Reaganomics or 28 years of Reaganomics. They have created such an economic disaster in this country with their trade policies, shipping jobs overseas. So we're no longer creating goods, which means that we're no longer creating wealth in this country. We're just basically, hey, would you like fries with that? You know, it's just moving money around in circles. We're not creating wealth any longer. And so our disastrous trade policies, our insane monetary policies, our insane fiscal policies, the borrow and spend, you know, Reaganomics that we've been pursuing for almost 30 years now has created such a disaster that they are just holding their fingers in the dike, hoping that they can keep the bottom from falling out before the election so that maybe John McCain and the Republicans will have a chance. And if they do that successfully and the bottom does fall out after the election, they're hoping that they can blame it on the Democrats. I don't think America is going to buy it. I think people have figured out what's going on. Fred in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Fred.
Hey, you know, I'm not going to stoop to finger-pointing about this economy the way that one economist was pointing fingers at the family. But I will say that there is a silver lining or to that cloud, this cloud that's up there, that we can all ponder because we'll have more time to ponder it. And that is that
because you're unemployed, you have more time to think.
That's right. You'll have more time to think about what got you into all into this mess, whether it's ourselves or George Bush or some other patsy or a boogeyman like Osama bin Laden, and what we're going to do about it. And, you know, social responsibility is something that this country has been devoid of too long because we've been living in the roaring 90s or roaring aughts, and we're basically blindsided by this Iraq war and blindsided by a lot of stuff because we had so much disposable income to take trips and vacations. And
that's
cruises.
Because the New Deal, that's because Keynesian economics, it's because Franklin Roosevelt's, And by the way, John McCain is running around now saying he's a Roosevelt Republican. He's talking about Teddy. He's hoping people will think he means Franklin. He doesn't explain that. But Franklin Roosevelt's policies created the largest wealth-generating machine in the history of the world, which was the United States, created this enormous, huge, massive, powerful middle class in the United States in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s. We were at the top of the, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor to the world. In other words, more people owed us money than any other country in the world. We loaned out money. We were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world. You think Japan was making stuff? You think Korea was making stuff? We, the United States, was the largest exporter of finished goods in the world in 1980 when Reagan, in the election in 81 when Reagan came into office. We were the largest importer of raw materials. We brought the ore in, we made steel, we converted the steel into cars and television sets and everything else, and we exported that stuff out. Now, here, 28 years later of Reaganomics, we are the world's largest importer of finished goods and the world's largest exporter of raw materials. Lumber, we're even exporting trash. We have gone from the world's largest creditor nation to we are now the world's largest debtor nation. 28 years of Reaganomics has turned us into a third world country by any definition. Andy in North Georgia. Hey, Andy, got about a minute before this break. What's up?
Is this Tom?
It is. You're on the air.
Oh, hey. Correct my paraphrase if I'm wrong, but I've heard you say that a high tax rate for the wealthy corresponds approximately to their use of the commons.
By and large, that's the theory, yeah.
Okay. What data supports that conclusion, or how do you reach that conclusion?
Well, I reached that conclusion because the commons supports the creation of all wealth. I mean, if you're gonna have a business, you need an educated workforce. That's part of the commons. If you're gonna use the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure, common sense, frankly, supports that conclusion. This is, okay. You know, the rationale that has been used forever. You don't. I'm not sure that you could enumerate it. But
right.
Could I
say that if a wealthy person has people working for him, he's their use of the commons, part of their use of the commons is used by him, as it were.
Certainly, because you're actually not creating jobs. What you're doing is you're creating wealth from people. I don't want to put it in an exploitative context because I don't think it's frankly exploitative in most cases.
Right.
But the reality is that the only reason anybody ever hires somebody is because that person can generate more cash for them than they cost.
Indeed.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you, Andy.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Ellen, who traveled with me, or actually I should say I traveled with Ellen, to Darfur in South Sudan back 2 weeks ago. Ellen, we put up a whole bunch of pictures from that trip along with captions over at TomHartman.com. If you click on Tom's blog, you'll be able to see them. I know that you've got a lot of them on your website over at TalkRadioNews.com.
Well, we're putting a whole lot more on, and of course, we're working on that documentary.
Yeah, that's absolutely great, and anything I can do to help, let me know. So, what's going on in Washington D.C. today?
Oh boy, it has been quite
a day. You have the accredited news department. Yes.
Well, first of all, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development resigned today. Got a good recommendation from the Bush administration, or a good goodbye thing from the Bush administration. But of course, there's a lot of problems. There was a housing authority in Philadelphia. They filed suit that he tried to punish the agency because they blocked a deal with a friend of his, supposedly. Then there's, of course, some Katrina stuff. Then there are some inspector general questions about some what they call problematic instances involving HUD contracts and grants. And remember, he said that comment about revoking contracts because of people's political leanings.
In other words, he's just been a good Bush Republican.
He's been a great Bush Republican, but he's bye-bye.
Yeah. Interesting.
The other thing, of course, is that this morning, Secretary Paulson outlined some plans to overhaul the financial service regulatory regime. He still believes that mortgages should be held on a and run and regulated on a state basis, but thinks
right.
that there should be a more overriding federal interest in that to take a look at it. And, of course, this is because so many of the international markets are completely spooked by what has been going on.
Yeah, we did our first hour on this. The only problem is he's suggesting that the agency that should oversee this stuff is the Fed, which is not a federal agency. The Fed is actually a private corporation owned by its member banks. And the only interaction it has with the federal government is that the administration gets to appoint the board members of the Fed to,
right.
I think, like 16-year terms or something, like 8 or 16.
Exactly.
You know, these very, very long terms.
And the chairman and all that.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's like, you know, Paulson's solution to the problem is to semi-privatize it, you know, move, you know, let's destroy more of the federal regulatory agencies. He wants to do away with the SEC, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that when Franklin Roosevelt set it up, the first chairman of it, this was a story that Gloria Swanson told me. She used to be on the board of the Community for Abused Kids that I was executive director
Gloria
of.
Gloria Swanson?
Yeah, yeah. She had been a vegetarian since the 1920s, and our program was a vegetarian program, and so she was on our board of directors. And I used to go down to New York every 6 months, and we'd hang out in her apartment and make dinner and talk and long into the evening about her life. She was absolutely wonderful and fascinating woman. And she, of course, was managed for a while by Joe Kennedy and was ripped off by Joe Kennedy and hated him passionately. And she said that when Franklin Roosevelt made him the first head of the SEC, he said to all his friends, he did so because it takes a crook to catch a crook. So.
Wow. Wow.
Anyhow, so Paulson wants to do away with the SEC. He wants to do away with the Securities and Exchange Commission and have the Fed, you know, take on more, and the states take on more of these responsibilities. This is just Reaganism on steroids. This is just libertarianism on steroids.
Well, yes, and it's certainly not going to pass the Democrats. I mean,
no, it's not. It's not going to happen. This is
just blowharding from the Bushies.
But if McCain is elected president, it will happen because the guy who's running the economic side of McCain's campaign, Phil Graham, is one of the first guys to propose this. He was the guy back John McCain and Phil Graham in 83 did a 2 or 3 month tour of hospitals and clinics all over the United States to try to shoot down Hillary Clinton's health care reform.
Well, McCain is going to have some troubles on this because there's going to be just a hue and cry, I think, and the Democrats are not going to let this go easily.
Yeah,
for sure. Speaking of the Democrats, the Politico today came out with a story that Hillary Clinton was about $2.5 million in the hole. Actually, I don't think that came from the Politico, but that did come, and that she had not paid. One of the bills that had not been paid was the health insurance for the staff.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's
not
a big
good.
Ouch.
That's a shame. I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm sure she didn't know about it. I mean, that's
yeah.
the problem. Who is her staffer who's not saying, you know, this is a priority?
Yeah, yeah. And she really, that's unfortunate. That's the kind of stuff that doesn't look good. Because up until this weekend, I was starting to have concerns that the Democratic Party was killing itself. And then Barack Obama came out this weekend and said she should stay in the race as long as she wanted,
exactly.
as she wants. And Bill Clinton pointed out.
She's formidable, but it's her, you know,
right.
Right to be here.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton's here in Oregon right now, and he pointed out yesterday that every single state that these two have a fight in, you see Democratic registrations double. I mean, you see voter registrations going through the roof. That's got to be a good thing long term. I mean, short term, it might look like there's a couple of bloody noses coming out of this, but I'm changing my mind, and I'm gradually here, and I'm becoming more and more inclined to think that Bill Clinton is right, that long term this fight going on may actually be a good thing for the Democratic Party.
Well, it would certainly be nice if it battle wears them, both of them, whoever's the nominee, so that they're ready to fight John McCain.
Yeah, well, I wish that both of them would spend more time attacking John McCain rather than each other. Well, and actually, I think Barack Obama has been doing that. Now, he's been kind of behaving like he's the nominee and taking on McCain. And Senator Clinton does from time to time, and I always salute her when she does that.
Some other things. The president today has left, and he's going to Ukraine. As you know, he's going to be meeting with President Putin, soon to not be president, but to be Prime Minister Putin.
Right.
And they are going to be working on several of these issues. And, of course, the other thing that is coming up very interesting. We certainly saw its presence in the Sudan is the whole China issue and what is going to be happening around that. They're sure to discuss it. Meanwhile, the NATO big issue is going to be Afghanistan, as well as who to admit into NATO.
Yeah. Any blowback from Gaddafi, who is now our ally and Bush's good buddy,
and who
on
show
Saturday?
Up today for
On Saturday, he got up and he said, "Where were all the Arab countries when a foreign nation invaded Iraq in 2003? He chastised them for not blowing back against us.
And then he didn't show up today for a conference he was supposed to do by video in Washington.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So what happens when a spy drone is over your house? I'm serious. An airplane, remote controlled, like the UAE, or What was the phrase that Bush used? Unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, that he said Saddam Hussein had and was going to use to whack us with. Right? It turned out it was a balsam wood airplane that Uday or Kusei had as a toy, but nonetheless, that was one of the things in his State of the Union address that he was talking about. What happens when a real spy plane is above your house, with perhaps an infrared sensor that can see through walls, or perhaps a microphone that can hear your conversations? Is this an invasion of privacy, or is this a reasonable step in law enforcement to policing the streets? And I think, you know, depending on how it's done and how it's handled, we could probably argue either side. Howard Simon, the executive director of the ACLU of Florida, is on the line. ACLUFL.org is their website. And Howard, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to chat with you.
Thank you, and thank you for coming and visiting with us. This Reuters says that Miami police could soon be the first in the United States to use cutting-edge spy-in-the-sky technology to beef up their fight against crime. This thing that looks like something that out of an alien movie, using electro-optic and infrared sensors and all these kinds of things. Here's what I see as the upside of this. My wife Louise and I were in London a couple of months ago, and for our 35th wedding anniversary, and also for some business meetings. And that city has more spy cameras on public streets. More people are observed by more cameras than any other place on Earth, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. And we went to an Indian restaurant in a rather sketchy part of town, but it was a restaurant that had that served a type of food dosas that I really wanted to get. I have celiac and can't eat anything with wheat. Anyway, long story short, it was a part of town where, as we were walking around, I was feeling actually rather good that there were all these spy cameras watching this public area. On the other hand, we have George W. Bush coming out and assuring us that if he's going to spy on somebody, he's going to use a warrant. He's going to do it right. Here's the clip.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. It's important for our fellow citizens to understand, when you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place when it comes to doing what is necessary to protect our homeland, because we value the Constitution.
So there's George Bush lying through his teeth. This was just a week before the New York Times exposed the fact that he had been spying on us without court orders and is continuing to. So any of these technologies are subject to abuse. What's the position of the ACLU in Florida on this?
Well, actually, it's somewhat very similar to what I heard you say in the opening remarks, namely that I don't think we ought to be afraid of technology. Technology can certainly improve the ability of law enforcement to protect the safety of the public. God knows how many examples of that. DNA is, everybody who watches crime. crime programs on television. DNA is the most widely known example, so we shouldn't be afraid of technology, but we shouldn't be employing technology without putting the safeguards in place, because every new technology, I think, has also within it grounds for the further erosion of privacy. And I think you alluded to some of it. You know, I could see a unmanned aerial vehicle, a drone, up over a hostage situation, for example, or a crime scene.
Makes perfect sense. We would want that, wouldn't we?
That sounds great. That sounds great. But in order to get there, it's going to fly over your backyard. Will it have the capacity to zoom into what's going on in the windows of your house, pick up conversation in your backyard? I mean, there are all sorts of issues like that. And I don't think we just willy-nilly adopt new technology without putting protections in place. Now, your clip from the president raised all sorts of different issues, which is even if you put protections in place, are we going to discover 10 years down the road that the government just simply ignored the protections? You know, that's a great piece of clip you had. The president is saying, don't worry, we're still required by the Constitution to require a warrant. And then it turns out that he ignored all of that. And,
right.
So anyway, at very least, you put the legal protections in place, hoping that there'll be enough oversight to make sure that the public officials are obeying the law, unlike
our
president.
Yeah, and in fact, in the UK, I think it was about 2 years ago, we actually did a show on it here on this program, and two, 3 years ago.
But let me just list all. I mean, think of all the things. Some of these things you and I just mentioned. Will it have the capacity to zoom into see what's going on in private areas and windows or over people's backyards?
Through your bathroom
window, for
example.
Will it pick up conversations? What if there have been examples of police officers getting bored, sitting behind a bank of closed-circuit TV cameras and zooming in on good-looking females.
Well, that's what I was going to tell you. In the UK, there was a huge scandal where they discovered that exactly was going on, and it was widespread, it was systemic, and it was the thing to do. And they cracked down on it, but it was a big deal.
So are the protocols going to have penalties for law enforcement that misuse it, or maybe, you know, make copies of the tape and show it to some of their buddies as they're zooming over backyards and people sunning themselves in their backyard? I mean, there are all sorts of protocols that need to be put in place before we just get seduced by not only new technology, but by the federal government throwing around Homeland Security money and trying to entice municipalities all over the country into adopting the new technology.
Well, and this is another concern, and that is the ongoing militarization of our police departments. We're seeing police department, SWAT teams exploding in number. Every day in America, at least one home has a door kicked in when it's the wrong home. I mean, it's over 365 a year. It's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. Once a day in America, something that never happened 30 years ago. I mean, literally or virtually never happened with SWAT teams anyway. People being shot when they're not, thinking that they're defending their home, when the cops think they have the wrong, when they have the wrong home and they think they're the bad guy's house. I mean, some of these are just tragic accidents, but there is all of this money that is being thrown at the military. There's all this surplus military equipment. There's all these defense contractors who want to get into the police business. And our police departments are increasingly looking like alien occupying military forces.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, you asked what's the position of the ACLU here. I mean, let me just kind of briefly say this is a perfect storm that's happening for some of the things you just said. You've got incredibly technology developing at an incredible pace. You've got the federal government throwing around Homeland Security money. You've got the vendors trying to seduce municipalities into putting up these cameras or using drones, we'll give you the first year free. And then you've got the lawmakers asleep at the switch, not enacting the minimal privacy protection legislation. So, I mean, you put all of that together, and we got a perfect storm in the United States of technology essentially totally eliminating what little remains of privacy in America.
So what do we do?
Well, what we do, we light a fire under the, it's what we're trying to do here in Miami. I mean, this is the Miami Police Department wants to put this in place. It's our job as the ACLU to light a fire under the Miami City Commission and say, now, wait a minute, maybe we don't want to just, put this in place. I mean, I want to emphasize, there's a use for this. We both of us just talked about good uses of this.
Sure.
You can, but you don't put it in place without saying, okay, what are going to be the limitations? How long are the tapes going to be held? Who has access to the tapes? Are there going to be penalties on police officers misusing the surveillance equipment? All of those kinds of things. So that we won't pick up conversations. We won't zoom into the windows of office buildings and private homes. So we want to use this stuff. It'll enhance public safety, but we better not allow the members of city councils and state legislatures to just give a blank check.
We just have a few seconds left, sir. Are you getting blowback from the city councilor, or are you getting cooperation?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Are you getting blowback from the city council or cooperation? We're just about out of time here.
It's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. That's how politics are in the country.
Indeed. Well, people can read all about it over at ACLUFL, as in Florida, .org. The ACLU of Florida, Howard Simon, the executive director. Dr. Simon, PhD. Howard, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you.
Great talking with you, too. 16 minutes past the hour. How much power should the police have in America? Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's enough to know my words are being heard, and we're fighting freedom here at home, so we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me, not my brother or even my mama. When they're on the line, I know you hear me one. Take that, Osama. Won't you please tell Condoleezza I ordered extra cheese. And I love her,
I love her,
cause she's out there,
she's out.
Here's
there.
How I know.
Here's how I know.
Not a stain on
the
dress.
Yeah, he knows that she's out there. Connie's out there listening. The whole bunch of them are out there listening. Oh my. But and this is a serious question. You know, at what point do we say George Orwell was right? I mean, this whole Big Brother society. What's interesting, the concept of the Big Brother society, that government would be this vast tutelary power, to quote, actually, Alexis de Tocqueville. And if, in fact, if you go back to 1836, in 1836, Alexis de Tocqueville was a 30-something young, wealthy French aristocrat. And he came over to the United States to see, well, what's this deal with this democracy in the United States? And as he was traveling around the United States, he saw a country that was, to a large extent, working. He was astounded by the fact that he could walk up to any farmer and engage in a conversation about international politics, and they actually knew what was going on. We had every little town had newspapers. They were all over the place because we subsidized them. We have always subsidized newspapers, fourth-class postage rate. Newspapers are subsidized through our postal service, the delivery of newspapers, and back then it was really important as we were a very rural nation. And But in one of the final chapters of Democracy in America, which was one of the three best-selling books of the 19th century, Democracy in America, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Trilby by Georges de Muller, the story of Svengali. Those three books were the three best-selling books of the entire 19th century. And Democracy in America, which is still in print, by the way, in toward the end of the book, there's this chapter called What Democratic Societies Have to Fear. And in it, he talks about looking into the future, and he says, I see something I don't even quite know how to describe. He says, I lack the words to describe it. And then he talks about this, in the absence of a free press, and this is the frame he put this thing in. And he says, you know, aristocracies can exist without a free press, no problem, but a democracy cannot exist. And in the absence of a free press, he said, he saw a future for America with this vast tutelary power reaching out and gently meeting the needs of Americans and shaping their will to its will. And I would say what he was describing is our modern consumer culture and our modern corporate media. It is absolutely downright spooky that in 1836, here's, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville describing modern America. But the thing is, in George Orwell's book, in 1984, in George Orwell's book, he suggested that Big Brother was government. And for, generations, people were concerned about government being that Big Brother power. And I would submit to you that no matter how much information the Miami Police Department has with their drone, that the local credit agency knows more about you than the Miami Police Department ever will. That an employer, I mean, this, for example, this is an article by Amy Son in the Oregonian. More than 53,000 Oregonians submitted their fingerprints to the FBI last year, but not because they were crime suspects. They did it to land a job. The laws have been so changed in this country, in large part because of an 1886 Supreme Court decision, that a corporation can now say that you, when you work for them, no longer have the First Amendment right to free speech. You no longer have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy. They can read your emails. They can monitor your keystrokes. They can even ask for your bodily fluids. You no longer have rights under the Constitution. They're suspended. But the corporation itself retains its First Amendment rights, in fact, including the right to lie. The corporation retains its Fourth Amendment privacy rights. They can conceal information. They retain their Fifth Amendment right not to testify against themselves. And so, for example, for years, the tobacco industry and the asbestos industry not only concealed but also lied about what they knew about the dangers and the deadly dangers of tobacco and asbestos. And now they're aggressively aggregating information about us. At what point do we as Americans say, enough already? We don't want the government in our bedroom, frankly, although we do appreciate it if they patrol the streets. God bless the police department for being there. But we don't want the government in our bedrooms, and we don't want corporations in our bedrooms either. Thank you very much. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. American. I am not afraid. I realize George Bush is terrified. I realize he wants all the rest of us to be terrified, but I am not afraid. Thank you very much. 34 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, our websites. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Gary.
Can I second the motion? I'm not afraid either.
Amen.
They're a bunch of... Oh, You know where I would go with that if I continued, right?
Yeah.
You just sense it, don't you? Hey, two things very quickly. Second, I'd like to quote de Tocqueville, if I may.
De Tocqueville, yes.
But first, I have a comment, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rich and the super rich, they created their own economy.
Yeah, they did, really.
And frankly, my own opinion, they're dirty little secret. They got a little dirty little secret out there. For the most part, not all of them, that they like it just that way, Tom.
Well, and that's how it was before 1929, too. And the problem is that it's not sustainable. It doesn't work. It eventually falls over. You get all this aggregated greed, I guess, would be the way to say it. And it creates this towering pinnacle of wealth that doesn't have enough of a base to it, and it falls over. And we're back there again. We're seeing statistics that we haven't seen in the United States since 1929. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to give you the quote quickly right now, but it just brings me to the point. FDR said it best, right? That it's the hatred of entrenched greed.
Yes. Yeah.
And the quote is this, if I may. De Tocqueville said, it's not that great fortunes should not exist. It's that they should not remain in the same hands. And that way, they do not form a class. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, and in fact, here this is the actual. I pulled out a copy of my book, Unequal Protection, in which I quoted at some length from de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America, his 1835 book, and he says the old words despotism and tyranny are inappropriate. The thing itself is new, and since I cannot name it, I must attempt to define it. So he's trying to describe this vision. He literally had this vision of a future America. He says, innumerable multitude of men. Incessantly endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives. Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power, which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratification and to watch over their fate. The power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It seeks to keep them in perpetual childhood. It gradually robs a man of all the uses of himself. After having thus successively taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioned him at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. It compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people until the nation is reduced to be nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals. And then he finishes the paragraph by saying, I think that men living in aristocracies may, strictly speaking, do without the liberty of the press, but such is not the case with those who live in democratic countries. Servitude cannot be complete if the press is free. The press is the chief democratic instrument of freedom. Dorothy in Raymond, Washington. Hey, Dorothy, what's up?
Oh, I just wanted to read to you an astounding Orwellian statement that Paul Craig Roberts reported in the paper of February 11th. It was prepared from a paper prepared for the NATO summit in April,
mm-hmm,
by five top military leaders: an American, a German, a Dutchman, a Frenchman, and a Brit. And this is it: the first use of nuclear weapons must remain in the quiver of escalation as the ultimate instrument to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction.
Right, this is the mutually assured destruction. Well, you're absolutely right, Dorothy, good point, and thank you for making it. It is Orwellian, and that was the basis of the mutually assured destruction notion that we held, you know, between us and the Soviet Union. But now Bush is extending that to Iran. Yeah, nukes for Iran. No, thank you. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's great to hear you for the first time on WINZ down here. You're on live since I've been here.
Thank you. Pleased to be there.
We're in bad shape if the press is what's going to save us. I wonder if you saw yesterday's Meet the Press with Spuds Russer interviewing Michael Hayden.
Yeah, I caught about half of that, frankly.
It's unbelievable. It fills me with such outrage and disgust. He doesn't answer a question. He just makes his talking points. And Russert never follows up. He asked him, what about waterboarding, the CIA waterboarding? He doesn't answer the fact that it's contractors doing it. He just says the CIA doesn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And then they ask him, what about the
idea that we contract it out to foreign governments as well.
Oh, exactly. Rendition. But
rendition.
I'm talking about right here. Our people, our government paying for it. They ask him, what about the question of, is it torture? And he had the hubris, the arrogance to say, that's not even really an interesting question for us. So he just sidesteps all the questions and makes his talking points. Russert never follows up. And our privacy, I mean, they've been wiretapping without warrants since before 9/11.
Right. They started this in the first year of the Bush administration. You're absolutely right. Charlie, thank you for the call and for making the point, spot on. And this is the problem, is when in 87, when Reagan stopped enforcing the, well, actually in 81, 82, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then in 87, when he stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, and I'm not talking about the part of the Fairness Doctrine that said they had that equal sides. I'm talking about the part of the Fairness Doctrine that said that you must program in the public interest, which meant providing real news. And then Bill Clinton in 96 signing the Telecommunications Act, which, you know, put the nail in that. What we ended up with after 96, 97, after Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, on top of Reagan having suspended the Fairness Doctrine, was that in the late 90s, the news departments of the networks, which used to lose money. I mean, I started in radio, WITL in Lansing, Michigan, back in 1968, at the age of 17, doing, you know, country western DJ, but, you know, 3 years later, after 3 years of doing music, I did 7 years of news on that station. And that station had a five-man news department. This is for a station in Lansing, Michigan, a small media market, or a medium-sized media market, a quarter million people at the time. And the station, I know, lost money on their news because that was the cost of having a license. And that has all changed. And so now what's happened is at the network level in particular, what you see is that it is about stars. These guys, I mean, Walter Cronkite was not making millions of dollars. The heroes of network television back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, they were not media stars, and they were not multimillionaires. And after... I still remember when CBS merged their or put their news division under their entertainment division. The VP of entertainment became in charge of news, and it was just an absolute shock. And so now you've got these guys who are making millions of dollars a year, many of them sitting in the White House press corps, by the way. They've become rock stars. They have become stars. And if you were making, say, a $4 or $5 million a year salary, and you knew that if you asked a tough question of a member of this administration, they would say, they would never again come on your program and talk with you, and therefore you would lose your job. Would you ask them a tough question? I mean, that's exactly what happened to Helen Thomas. She asked a tough question of George W. Bush, and he sent her to the back of the room. And this is just a terrible thing. Joey in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Joey, what's up?
Hey, first, can you mind if I plug the charity real quick?
Go for it.
Okay, it's a HOPE. It's a humanitarian organization for Palestinian equality. It's a help and feed some of the refugees that got caught up in the middle of some of the wars and stuff over there. You know, okay. Give them medicine and stuff. And if you want more information, you can call Kim Cashman at 313-282-4919.
Okay.
Or you can email me at joeyadamie@gmail.com. joeyadamie@ gmail.com.
All righty. And
thank
but
you
that's
very
not,
much.
Okay, you're welcome, Joey. Thanks a lot for the call. Mark in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I really want to commend you on the way you present different points of view on your show, and you're a great source of information.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you if you could take it to the next level. We need to know what to do about it, and I think you have the opportunity to make a daily element of your show concrete solutions to some of these problems. Is that something you're willing to take on?
Well, I think I've been doing that all along. I mean, the number one solution is to get people who understand these problems elected to public office. The Republicans have been drinking the Kool-Aid for 30 years. They have bought into the whole libertarian, government. There's no value to government. You know, the whole Ronald Reagan thing. You know, where he says,
I've always felt the most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
And you know, the Republicans, I mean, they're lost. What we need to do is elect more progressives.
Tom, I appreciate that point of view. And, yes, you're right. We do need to elect better representatives, but there's a lot more work to do, and we need instructions. As you said in that quote, we've been softened, and people need to know a little bit more about the concrete steps. And if you were able to help us with daily tasks about how to focus our energies, we might have a better shot at really manifesting some change.
Yeah. Well, I don't pretend to have all the answers, Mark, and your point is well taken. With regard to the banking situation that we were talking about in the first hour, we need to bring back, we don't need to do away with the SEC like Paulson is proposing. We need to re-empower them. In 2003, the Bush administration, as I said, we have learned these lessons before. In 2003, the Bush administration held this press conference where they showed up with garden shears and a chainsaw to say, we're cutting banking regulations. So they cut banking regulations, and what did it bring? A bank meltdown! You don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that we need to roll some of this stuff back. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Is it Willie Horton, or is it Horton Hears a Who? The discussion over in our chat room. You can get there by going to TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com on the Tom Hartman page and just click the link to our live chat room. Also, our blog and message board over at TomHartman.com. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. We only have about 9 minutes before we've got to wrap up today's show, so I'm going to go fairly quick. If you can kind of keep it short, because we've got a whole mess of phone calls here. Tom in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom.
You are on the air.
I wrote a book about supply-side economics and globalization about 4 years ago. And basically what it's about is, how do you stimulate, how do you create, how do you circulate wealth? Do you do it from the top, or do you do it from the middle? And there's no doubt in what's going on today. But one of your callers asked, what can we do about this? Here's what we do. You go to your local newspaper, and I don't care who it is, it's going to be run by a corporation, and it's going to be a spokesman for corporations. So to do it, you know, to do something through the grassroots, you know, if especially in smaller towns, you know, the big cities, it's a little bit harder.
No, but I got it, but can you get to the point, Tom?
Yeah, just that. You protest the local newspapers. They're
yeah.
the ones
we,
that are...
We have done this, you know, here in Portland, for example, the local newspaper is the Oregonian, which is actually a pretty good paper. It's owned, however, by a company in New York. I believe it's Newhouse owns it. And when the Downing Street memo came out, the Downing Street minutes, they didn't cover it for a week. And we were on the air here in Portland, and we were talking about it. And there were protests out in front of the newspaper. In fact, I've got a picture on the wall here of some people holding a big banner standing in front of the Oregonian saying, cover the Downing Street minutes. And they did. They ultimately did. They did a whole, in fact, they did a very, very good job of it. So I think, you know, you're right. You can talk back to your media. Pat, Miami, Florida. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Tom, man, I'd like to welcome you to the Miami market.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I used to listen to you all the time, and then I had no choice, and now I get to listen to you again.
Thank you very much.
It's good to hear somebody who actually, I hate to say this, limits the phone call and speaks to the people rather than let the people speak to the other people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Pat. Thank you very much. Your very kind words. Philip in Boca Raton. Hey, Philip.
How you doing? Let me give you a quick solution, what we should do. First of all, the money that Bear Stearns made, that 3-5% origination fee,
yeah,
the company cannot declare a dividend until they fork up that 3-5% fee back to the taxpayer.
Yeah, in other words, pass back for your profits. Is that what you're talking about?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, see, what you're suggesting, though, is that the Bear Stearns losses should be borne by the stockholders, and that's something that's totally anathema to all of the guys in the Bush administration, because they're all the stockholder class, you know?
As far as the foreclosures, let me quickly give you a suggestion. What we ought to be doing is allow for depreciation of homes, which is the same thing you do in a commercial real estate market. And
yeah.
the advantage of doing that is suddenly there will be a positive cash flow, and people will desire to own homes, not lose their homes.
Well, that's,
so that's nothing we can do as far as the tax code. Yeah.
That's a very interesting suggestion, that homeowners should be able to claim depreciation the same way a business can. Although it is an appreciating asset, at least in theory. Fascinating thought. Let me ponder that for a little bit. Isaac in New Haven, Michigan. Hey, Isaac, listening to WDTW.
How are you?
I'm good.
Just don't worry about it, Tommy. JC's got your back.
Okay.
He's got your back. Stay the whole firm. I see you waver, but you stand right up firm. I want to listen to you. But really, I call also about Sunday. I think it's Sunday evening, Saturday or Sunday evening, I caught you on radio discussing these boxes coming on these televisions in regards to being controlled. Is that a fact?
No, I don't think so, Isaac, because I do the show here at noon to 3 Eastern time, live, 9 to noon Pacific time, Monday through Friday. So I'm not on the air Saturday or Sunday, unless you were hearing a replay of one of our shows. And in that case, I'm not sure which one it would be. Phil in East Tennessee. Hey, Phil, what's up?
I was wondering, everybody seems to be afraid to discuss national socialism. And when I hear people argue about it, it's obvious that no matter what political viewpoint they're from, they do not understand the definition of it and don't realize it was created during the robber baron era.
You're doing national socialism as in Nazism?
Yeah, national socialism, where you have an extreme form of patriotism that owes no allegiance to laws or principle, and dissent is not tolerated, and you have basically a corporate welfare state.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you go back to Mussolini's definition of fascism. It was the merger of corporate and state interests. And certainly that was one of the early things that Hitler did, was bring the corporations in, privatize everything to the extent that it could be done. Absolutely. Gary in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for all the work you do. I hope you enjoyed your visit to my hometown, Missoula, last weekend.
I did.
Just wanted to say hi. Thank you for everything. I just got out of the Obama headquarters in southeast Portland here. About your age, and I'm going to work for Obama.
Okay, good on you, Gary. Anybody getting involved in politics, God bless. I think that's absolutely great. Thanks a lot for the call. Gary in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Tom. You know, you were talking about fear a little while ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's wrong with me, but the only thing that I fear is what the government's doing to us, ruining our air and our water, and not having... We won't have Social Security when we get older, and we won't have Medicaid.
Yeah, but see, we don't need to fear that. We need to get active. We need to do something about it. You know, Gary, your point is well taken, but it is time for us to get out there and speak up and say, number one, we're not going to do it.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And number two, that we are going to step up to the plate, and we are going to take this country back. One precinct at a time, you know, county by county, city by city, state by state, right across the nation. We're going to return democracy to this country. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating Scott Gray, head of broker lending for ING Direct, about whether the mortgage rate freeze is a good idea or not. And Corey Powell, executive director of Discover Magazine, will be here to tell us 20 things you didn't know about mating. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.